Now we're going to take a look at the whole question of marriage and family, how people really lived as far as we know. And you will know here and in some other ones, other segments, that we're using a lot of Latin terms and we're talking about Roman. Well, as I think I've explained before, but I'll say it again, these people are living in the Roman world, whether they're living actually at Rome, which some of them were, but or all over the empire, in cities of the Eastern Mediterranean. They're living in a world that is dominated by Rome and by Roman customs and Roman law. So that's why we're doing this. And also, to be honest, there's more known today about Rome at this period than about many of the subcultures. And there were subcultures, and that's an important thing also to say, is that not everybody thought of themselves as Roman. Certainly not everybody's Roman citizen. But it's the dominant culture. And if you understand that, if you do some analysis even of your own situation where you are, you can identify what is the dominant culture, what is sort of the public expectation, while at the same time, there are all kinds of other subcultures that are going on. Okay? So, we go into marriage and family. And family is the most common social and biblical metaphor. We use family all the time. Family values, family life, the family of nations. You can think of all of the expressions that we use in which we use family to say something. And in the Bible as well, it's an image because it's such a present social reality for everybody. Everybody comes from some family somehow and is embedded in some kind of a social group, which either is or simulates a family. So it is a really root image. The picture that you have there, you're gonna see pieces of it again and again. This is a funerary monument from Ravenna, but it's from the Roman period, first century, very, very Roman in everything that it represents. And there are inscriptions on it, which we'll talk about later. But you see that at the top there's grandma. There's an older woman at the top, and then a couple with a small child, girl, and then two seemingly unrelated young men and a boy at the bottom. And each of them has a history that is given in the inscriptions, but we'll come back to that. So, some meanings of family. I don't know what your first connotation is when you hear the word family. It will depend very much on your culture. In this world, in the world of the New Testament and of early Rome, there are three major ways in which that word is used. The first is what we would call vertical. That is your ancestry, your family tree, your grandparents and great-grandparents and ancestors, and children and grandchildren. The line of family as it goes through history. That's certainly one of the meanings. A second meaning is everyone who is related to each other by blood or marriage, horizontally, everybody who's in existence today and relating with each other, the people who come together when you have a family reunion, you know? And the third meaning here is the residents of a house. Whether they are related or not related, this is more the connotation of property. Of everyone who is under the authority of the under the potestas. Remember we talked about that? The authority of the head of the family, the head of the household. That is also, in Latin, the most common word is familia. And that can be deceptive because we assume that it means the same thing. We mean by family, and it doesn't necessarily, you see. In Greek, there are two words, oikos and oikia. And the oikia more likely tends in the property direction rather than the people, but not always. It can be very fluid. Now, what these terms do not usually refer to is what is, at least in the West, today, the most common understanding of family, which is the nuclear family. Father, mother, and children. It does not refer to that. And one of the Latin jurists, scholars of the law, actually said, we don't have a word for that. We don't have a word for the unit of father, mother, and children. Because everything is more extended. All of the ideas, it take in more people than that. So we have to be careful about that when we think about it. Now, I don't know, it depends on where you live and what your cultural experience is, what you think marriage is. And in this culture that we're talking about, most often, and this is also from an approach of anthropology, marriage is not a romantic union between two people. Marriage is a contract between two families for the sake of offspring, the next generation, and for the transfer of property. So it's a relationship of convenience for the families, for the two families. It is the two families who come together, who make these arrangements. In the best of circumstances, the bride and groom will consent to it. Sometimes they didn't have much ability to consent, particularly when you were talking about a girl married off very early and before she really could consent, could have enough sense of herself to consent. You know, if you do any reading in the European, modern Europe and its royal families, you find the same thing. You find children who are betrothed to each other when they're like 3 years old, you know. And why? It's because these are advantageous relationships for their parents. So marriage has many different meanings in different cultures. And you see, maybe today we think that arranged marriages are not a good idea. That young people should have the freedom to choose whom they're going to spend the rest of their lives with. But if you're in a context in which marriage is understood as this arrangement between two families, arranged marriages they make sense within that context. Not always for the benefit of the young people who are married, unfortunately, but you have to think of marriage in this way. And should then a romantic, a loving union develop, so much the better. And it often did. Maybe for the majority of times, we just don't know. But it was not something that was necessary as a prerequisite for marriage. At the bottom of the screen there, you see marriage cum manu and sine manu, and let me explain this. Manus is also a legal term, Roman law term, that means the transfer of the bride into the groom's familia. This means she is legally no longer a member of her own family. She is now a member of her groom's family, which means she cannot inherit from her own family. And she cannot bequeath property to her own family. So it's a legal separation. Roman marriage was done this way for a number of centuries, but this was going out of style right before the New Testament period. And Instead, what developed was what we call a marriage sine manu. And the interesting thing is that that's a modern adaptation. Cum manu is the ancient term, but sine manu, without manus, is really a modern adaptation. We don't have any ancient texts that talk that way. But what this meant was a marriage closer to something like what we're familiar with. That is, the bride remains a member of her own familia, and it's a question of inheritance, back and forth. The older way went out of fashion, we think, because of the difficulty of the bride's family losing its property. The bride would bring property into the marriage, and it would be lost to her own family. And so that grew out of style, and they began to change it so that wives remained members of their own familia legally. Now, what the problem that this created was in the marriage itself, that now you have two entities owning property and trying to work that out together. And so when you had considerable property involved, they'd have to make a careful separation. And in the case of divorce, which was fairly common, they had to be able to know from the beginning, sort of like what in the U.S. now, I think we call a prenuptial agreement, an arrangement in which, in the case of divorce, it's clear which property goes where. Because, as many, I'm sure, of you know, in the case of divorce, it can be very messy to try to separate property. So that was the problem then that was created when they changed that. However, the marriage sine manu, the marriage in which the bride remained a member of her own family, was actually a step forward for women, because the women then retained their rights to their property. The right to administer the property. When in the old ways, cum manu, the bride brings the property into the marriage, it actually becomes her husband's property, you see. So now, women, married women, can control their own property. It belongs to their familia, you know, all of it belongs to the familia, but they have better control over it. Something on age at marriage. The picture you see here is a painting from a tomb in Pompeii in which someone must have been very proud of their family silver and painted a picture of it on the wall of the tomb. So you get some sense of what the best silver tableware looked like. So age at marriage, we know something about this, and how do we know? Mostly from epitaphs, mostly from funerary memorials. When girls died, and of course, I haven't said anything about life expectancy, many, many children died, and young people died. When a girl died before marriage, she's commemorated by her parents. When a girl dies after marriage, she's commemorated by her husband. This is the usual thing. And so that's how you can tell who's married and who isn't married. And a general pattern is that boys entered into their first marriage in their mid-20s, mid to late 20s, and girls in their late teens, sometimes middle teens, depending, again, on the social status. In wealthier families, girls tended to be married earlier because those are family arrangements that are going to benefit the family, and so let's get her married. Whereas in poorer families, to the extent that we have the information, the girl tended to be older, probably because the family needed her labor until it was time for marriage. So this is first marriage. So girls, sometimes as much as 10 years, younger than their husbands, which sets up the dynamic, of course, of an older, more experienced man marrying a younger, less experienced girl, And it fits quite well into a pattern of subordination of women, of wives. Even though there's a lot of household literature, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, that suggests that even at an early age, when a girl enters into marriage, she's expected to know how to manage a household, which includes managing the slaves, the household slaves, if they're people of sufficient wealth to have that. So, it's an interesting dynamic, and we'll talk more about that another time. Divorce. Divorce was commonly practiced, and often it was, again, the families that would want to initiate the divorce. Among politically placed people, I guess it happened more often. I think I would say it happened more often for political reasons. That is, this wife no longer is going to, her family connections are no longer going to get me appointed where I want to be appointed, and so I'm going to divorce her and marry another woman from another family whose family connections are better for me. I mean, that kind of thing happened. Among more ordinary people, divorce would not be perhaps for those reasons, but for other reasons of incompatibility, whatever, infidelity. And in the case of divorce, as I said, the later kind of a marriage arrangement was much easier in terms of transferring property. Now, this is all Roman practice, and as I said, that set the tone. One of the things we really don't know is among, for example, Jewish couples who were not Roman citizens, would they have followed these customs or not? And we simply don't know. We just don't have enough evidence to know. So all we can do is say that the predominant model was this, and that the evidence we have is for people who are living this way in their marriage. And I should say also with divorce that remarriage was quite common. And at the political level, there's almost no divorce without remarriage. The point is the remarriage. The point is the more advantageous marriage. And so, but with other people, we do know, in some cases of Jewish people too, divorce for incompatibility, a variety of reasons, without necessarily remarrying. And a divorced woman would return to her own family. Children, whereas today, at least in most Western customs, in the case of divorced children, are more likely to go with the mother. In this case, no, they went with the father because they are part of his familia, his potestas. And so a woman who was divorced was most likely to lose custody of her children. And these are all some of the realities of marriage and divorce. But marriage is, of course, a universal, almost a universal cultural custom, but very differently understood in different ways in different times and places. Amen.
Interesting.